Good evening. You are listening to The Truth Tank, and I am your host, The Tank. And we'll be picking up right where we left off, continuing our epic review and recap of Jurassic World Dominion and Top Gun Maverick. Without wasting any time, we'll get straight into the episode. This is episode 39 of The Truth Tank, Jurassic World Dominion, Top Gun Maverick, review and recap, part 2. So my opinion, I don't really think Colin Trevorrow had the directing or writing experience to pull off a story of this scope and complexity. Unlike Jurassic World, where I think he had a very clear vision of what he was doing and what he wanted to say and achieve, he gets some of those ideas out in Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. But in this one, he is definitely saving a majority of his bad ideas for this film. He seems so determined to put every one of these ideas and subplots into the movie, it makes it very hard to know what is happening or what way the audience is really meant to look. And it also completely detracts from the action and the characters. You just don't really care because you have no idea which way you're supposed to be going. He definitely seems like he's trying to shove all these ideas into one film. Less is more should have definitely been applied to the script. And it's not just his fault. I mean, he's working with a bunch of younger and I think very inexperienced writers. I think they all needed to be fired, and he needed to have a more experienced writing team around him. You know, Universal could have hired some pro writers like Aaron Sorkin or David Kemp. David Kemp has written the previous Jurassic Park films, so why wasn't he called in to pen Jurassic World with Colin Trevorrow? I mean, the guy wrote the first film, and I'm pretty sure the second film, with Michael Crichton. He has had more than enough experience with Jurassic Park films, and films in general. I mean, he's written lots of them, and they're usually pretty good. So someone like that needed to be brought in to the writing team, and not just a bunch of young, late 20s, mid 30s, we're out of college and we have great young people ideas, let's try and make blockbusters. Because it didn't really work. Universal could afford these people, they just didn't, because they're more concerned about bottom line profits than they are about good storytelling. They didn't even have to go that far. They could have hired a couple of other good writers. But oh no. They also probably should have brought Spielberg back for the final one. But the sad thing is, Universal could have thrown money at these guys to get them to come back. But I get a sense that they clearly didn't care about this film. They just were too preoccupied with how much money they were going to make. Let's just make it nostalgia driven. Let's put all these old characters in it. People are going to come back because, like Malcolm said, they didn't do the work themselves, they just stood on the shoulders of giants. And that's basically what this trilogy, and specifically this film, has been built around. The success of Jurassic Park 30 years ago, the characters that were created in that, they just pretty much brought back to get the old fans back into the theatre and to spend money. And this is in a time where, you know, people aren't going to the movies as much because of COVID and all the shutdowns. So it could have been a financial gamble. I mean, Jurassic World did well, but I'm not sure how well Fallen Kingdom did. So it may or may not have paid off. The bean counters want their investment money back, and it seems like that's about the only thing they actually cared about. The bean counters got cheap and were more concerned about making money, which they would have made back tenfold anyway if the movie was actually good. Word of mouth is still one of the best ways of getting people to go and see a film. All this just leads us to another dumb subplot, one that overshadows the main plot. Unfortunately, it seems like this subplot wasn't meant to be confusing, and you can tell that Trevorrow and his writing partner Emily Carmichael would have been pretty pleased with their efforts, because it must have made them feel smart by putting this in it, but really it just detracts from everything that is happening in the story. This brings us down to one of the bigger character entrances in the film, and that is the return of Sam Neill's Dr. Alan Grant. His entrance to the story is nice. He's working at a dig site. I mean, where else are you going to find the world's most popular paleontologist but on a dig site, teaching a group of students how to dig up dinosaur bones? It's somewhere in Utah or somewhere like that, very similar to the first one, but not quite. And that's one of the big problems with the reintroduction to some of the older characters, is that they are good, they are pretty well written and directed. They just seem very rushed and very short. It feels like, let's just introduce this character, get him out of the way so then we can move on to the next thing as quickly as possible. You know, and like I said, this is already a pretty long and drawn-out movie. And Grant's introduction is no different. The scene in the tent is very much a nod of the cap to the original Jurassic Park trilogy. I feel like this has been done before in Jurassic Park 3, when he's in a tent discussing something with his partner. He always seems to be in either a tent or an RV, but I guess it's the world of a paleontologist. But at the same time, something feels like it's missing. It's a nice scene. It's very reminiscent of the original Jurassic Park. Sam Neill and Laura Dern have great chemistry like they did in the first one. It feels very real. The characters feel realistic, and they're kind of picking up where they left off, you know, 20 years ago in Jurassic Park 3. It's a nice scene, and it's one of my favourites in the film. The nostalgic element to Sattler and Grant's reunion does seem very genuine, and it is definitely one of the better moments and highlights of the film. So Ellie convinces Grant to accompany her to Bison headquarters to see Malcolm. Although it is likely that Malcolm would take a job at a company as shady as Bison, the plot setup is just a little too convenient and it runs a little too smooth for a franchise that thus far has been a pretty bumpy ride. Malcolm does fill in the blanks as to why he took a job with a shady company like Bison. I think Ellie or Alan asked him why he would take a job like that, and it's because he has lots of children and ex-wives to support, which is something that's mentioned in Jurassic Park 1 and 2. So, Alan and Ellie get on a Bison company plane that has been sent to pick them up. They get on this fancy plane, they head over to Bison headquarters, and there's a kind of like a quarantine center for dinosaurs that have been relocated to the sanctuary there. The dinosaurs are held there, there's a lot of animatronic dinosaurs, which is nice to see. It's very reminiscent of the previous films. They're walking around, there's all these Bison employees in these grey uniforms, which is, you know, a little totalitarian looking, but I'm guessing that was the point. They seem very friendly and explain they get a health check and they stay here for a couple of weeks before being moved into the sanctuary. So this is about the point in the film where things start to get very sci-fi. They get so science fiction-y in some parts of this story that it feels like that this movie could have been set in the near future and not so much the present. Because there's a lot of science fiction elements that have just been mixed in for good measure, because, you know, the science fiction elements of bringing dinosaurs back to life wasn't enough. I mean, there's little elements of Blade Runner, Westworld, the original Jurassic Park, and a lot of other science fiction movies. And it's not just science fiction movies, there's a lot of science fiction themes that have been mixed into this. I mean, yeah, like I just said, Jurassic Park is science fiction, but it's just not this type of science fiction. So some of the overarching themes of the Jurassic Park series are obviously the illusion of control and the loss of it, and tampering with genetics and things that we don't fully understand yet, and playing God. The Island of Dr. Moreau is another book and movie that delves into a similar topic. And Michael Crichton, I'm pretty sure, is pretty interested in genetics and playing God. A couple of his stories have all been very similar. The illusion of control and playing God. Congo kind of hints at this. Westworld, and that was his first movie he directed and wrote, I'm pretty sure, back in the 70s. And unfortunately, he's not around anymore to add his take to Jurassic Park, which Jurassic World definitely would have turned out different if he was still among us. R.I.P. to one of the greatest writers ever. And Westworld is a perfect example of that, the movie and the TV show. The show, more so than the movie, shows the illusion of control. It's very similar to Jurassic Park, except it has robots, if you haven't seen it. There's a couple of spoilers coming up. It's pretty much set in the near future. Westworld is a Western-themed theme park. The robots are there for the tourists' pleasure. You can shoot them, kill them, rape them, do whatever you want to them. The TV show dives into the artificial intelligence aspect of it more than the movie does. So what happens when these robots start to remember? They have their memories wiped. So what happens when they remember and start to put pieces of the past back together, and they start to lash out and realize that they're the superior life form? Cut a long story short, things don't go very well. All control is lost, and mayhem breaks out in Westworld. The robots rise up and pretty much start killing the guests, much the same way as Jurassic Park does, but Westworld is artificial intelligence where Jurassic Park is organic. So in the TV series, in the third season, the robots get out of the park and spread all around the world, causing mayhem and the collapse of society, which bring up bigger issues such as what does it mean to be human, control, social issues, human and artificial life form rights, and the dangers of artificial intelligence. So if Colin Trevorrow hadn't have seen that, maybe he should have watched it before he wrote the script for Jurassic World Dominion. Because the way the robots spread around the world is pretty cool. Obviously, it's a lot easier for a robot that looks like a human to get around the world than it is for a dinosaur. But it's a lot more convincing. It doesn't make the big claim like Dominion, where you think it's the entire planet. There's a whole bunch of smaller events that happen all around the world with different robots that all kind of lead into a endgame in Season 3 and a bigger overarching plan. So this brings us down to Maisie Lockwood, the clone girl. I mean, I thought that was fucking stupid. Cloning dinosaurs is one thing, but humans is a different barrel of fish. And obviously cloning is one of the main aspects of Jurassic Park, but I think this was pushing the envelope a little too far. It's a little too science fiction-y, and it's just not really explained well enough. There's a detailed explanation to the Lockwood backstory in Dominion, but it really doesn't make a lot of sense. And that brings me to the whole Lockwood story in Fallen Kingdom and Jurassic World Dominion. It's unnecessary, in my opinion. I think it takes away from the original trilogy and serves a very, very dumb link between the two films, Fallen Kingdom and Dominion. Makes me think, if they got rid of the whole Lockwood storyline from Fallen Kingdom and from Dominion, the story would have been a hell of a lot better. It would have been a lot smoother, and that's one more annoying subplot that's been cut out of the film. The subplots in this movie don't really seem to go anywhere. They either just lead to an action set piece and are dropped, or don't go much further, or are literally just forgotten 30 or 40 minutes later into the film. And that's one of the subplots I didn't really like. I also thought the Lockwood plot took away from John Hammond, because he isn't mentioned in Dominion at all. Which is sad and annoying, because Hammond serves a link between both trilogies. So, the baddies are poaching dinosaurs and watching Chris Pratt's place for the cloned girl. She isn't meant to go out, in case she gets spotted by the bad guys downtown. But guess what? She defies Claire and Owen's wishes, and she goes out anyway. She goes wandering through a sawmill where a couple of brontosauruses have stumbled in to the back lot and are led away by some workers. It's a cool scene, and this leads to the kidnapping of Maisie Lockwood. So now enter Blue. So Blue and Blue's baby are in it for a little bit in the start, not much. There's some really nice, genuine moments of them hunting, which are some of the most realistic and most heartfelt scenes in the entire movie. And I really wanted more of them. And this is what I mean about Trevorrow's directing. He can be so good and so literal with some scenes in the movie, but then just lose the plot 15 or 20 minutes later. Though some of the most authentic scenes when they're hunting in the snow, hunting foxes and rabbits, the rest of the film is such a clusterfuck. So it is very frustrating to sit through a movie like this that has such good moments in it, but then just throws a script straight out the window. Blue's baby is kidnapped at the same time as Maisie Lockwood by the same baddies. Pratt tracks down the bad guys. He sees Blue's baby being taken and put in the back of a truck and driven out of the forest. A little bit of a shootout ensues with the main bad guy and Owen. Now comes one of the most emotionally convincing moments of the film. Blue confronts Owen, who promises to bring her back with all the conviction of a teenage Nickelodeon actor. And the emotional conviction I'm talking about is not coming from Chris Pratt. The most convincing part of the film is in Blue's reaction. Blue is very upset and very distressed at her baby disappearing. The facial effects are some of the most impressive in the entire film and some of the most emotionally convincing from Blue. The visual effects are good, but they're not overly impressive, which you would expect from a Jurassic World film. I think modern special effects focus on the movement of characters and creatures more so than the look. There's something that doesn't quite look right. I think the originals, in comparison, had much more realistic looking dinosaurs. Blue gets disrespected big time in this film. She is the only dinosaur in the new trilogy besides the T-Rex to really be in all three films and provide that common emotional thread between dinosaurs and human characters. She is a main character and has been with Owen since the first film. They have an interesting relationship, one that's built on trust. She risks her life to save them in Jurassic World, and he risks his life to save her in Fallen Kingdom. Some of the best scenes in the film are when we're reintroduced to Blue, hunting in the snow with her baby. They're some of the highlights of the movie. But ultimately, she gets disrespected. After she confronts Owen, she pretty much disappears from this story. There could have been so many better ways to write her into the movie. I mean, it would have... At this point, you could pretty much chuck anything in it, and it would be believable. She should have gone with Owen and accompanied him to Malta to try and find her baby. Blue's baby is called Beta, and when she is taken by the poachers, she comes looking for Owen for assistance. You know, shit should have gotten real, but it's handled appallingly. And as I was saying about all the emotional nuances in Blue's face and how, you know, intense her facial reactions are, Colin Trevorrow managed to drain all the emotion out of it, which is the only emotional part of the film and pretty much the entire trilogy. The scene is directed so clumsily. Blue lashes out at Owen finally, and she slashes his hand. When in reality, it would have taken his fucking hand off. All the shots of Blue lashing out are not really shown, and all the action is shot through their eye contact and hand motions. Yeah, and I get the eye contact and hand motions is a big part of their relationship, but that doesn't really explain why you don't really see a lash out in this scene, given that it is the only emotional scene in the entire movie. There's also no blood. Owen barely seems to register the injury and doesn't really seem to feel much pain. He wraps it up. You know, doesn't get an infection or anything. Doesn't slash open an artery or a vein. He doesn't bleed to death. In reality, it probably would have taken his hand off. It would have been better if he had just been killed or eaten right there. And think how dirty raptor claws would have been. If you got a slash from it, you'd probably get a nasty infection pretty soon after. So unfortunately, Blue is not seen again until the end of the film. It's a very sad end to a dinosaur who is the only character in the trilogy that actually has a story arc. And Trevorrow handles one of his main original Jurassic World characters appallingly and disrespectfully. So this leads Owen to make a promise to a dinosaur. It would have been better and more believable if Blue went with Owen for the ride. And at this point in the story, anything would have been believable. She could have accompanied him to Malta and on his adventures to try and save Beta. It would have made more sense because if you go back to Jurassic World, the raptors are masters of tracking. This is mentioned in Jurassic World where they play that game. They get them to smell and track down something, and they make a game of it, which comes back in Jurassic World where they get the chunk of the Indoraptor and they get the pack of raptors to smell it, pick up its scent, and chase it down over miles. They can pick up scents from miles away. This wouldn't have been a unbelievable element to put into the script. It would have actually made a hell of a lot more sense than what happens later in the film. And if, you know, Owen smuggles Blue onto a plane and they go out looking for Beta, she could pick up the scent and lead them to the bad guys, set up a next action set piece, yada yada yada. And it would have been a nice way to incorporate Blue back into the story, but oh no, she's completely written out of it. And it would have been cool. It also would have been the story arc and ending that Blue deserved, which unfortunately isn't the one that she got. The annoying guy from Fallen Kingdom is now working for the CIA, in particular the CIA Animal Division, which is very similar to the ex-military plot in a lot of action movies and in Jurassic World. It's like the script is trying so hard to legitimize itself in the modern action genre, you know, i.e. the Bourne movies and every other action movie that has been made. Has to have some, you know, covert government agency angle to it. I mean, even the Fast and the Furious movies have done this. It's gone from, you know, street racing in fucking downtown Los Angeles to working for Mr. Nobody and basically being the feds in high-performance cars. And this is kind of the same thing. Now we have the CIA angle where they've set up an animal division to try and find and monitor dinosaurs. Yeah, on the one hand, it's probably realistic and it is kind of cool. In terms of the story, it's just eating up time and it really doesn't go anywhere. So this is something I've noticed with a lot of the Universal movies that are being made lately. They all have to have some type of government agency link. Q curious. Maybe Universal is trying to tell us something. So, this character, I can't remember his name. He's not important enough to look up. He helps Owen and Claire track down the guy that kidnapped Maisie and Blue's baby overseas, where they have ex-Jurassic World employees working as undercover agents for the CIA to try and shut down illegal dinosaur smuggling rings, which is kind of a cool idea. I did like it. I mean, you can imagine that happening if this was reality. It's one of the subplots and ideas of the film that should have been in a hell of a lot more. It was a perfect setup to bring back previous characters from Jurassic World, which they did to a small degree, but then as soon as the action's over, it's kind of dropped. The CIA guy also mentions that Claire is a person of interest of the CIA, which, you know, I can't imagine why. Really, she should be in jail for a very long time. She has broken a lot of laws in all three films. So there's a lot of animatronic dinosaurs mixed in with a lot of visual effects dinosaurs. It's a nice throwback to the original trilogy, and it's a pretty decent blend of visual effects and animatronics, which is kind of what Jurassic Park is all about, mixing these two elements to create believable dinosaurs, and Dominion does it very well. There's more dinosaurs in this one than I think any of the others combined. But unfortunately, the story is so weak and so confusing that it just comes off like nostalgia with no substance. By this point in the script, the subplots are adding up, and the audience is being led down a few different story paths that really don't lead to anywhere. There are too many subplots to follow, and most of them are not followed up or ended adequately. There's too many dinosaurs, there's a lot of stuff that they just try to jam into this movie to try and end off the trilogy. In my opinion, all it managed to do was make the movie really cheesy and really just show a lack of direction. There's just too much going on and there's too many directions to follow to make a coherent story, which makes the main story very hard to follow. It does take you out of the story and the action, and it detaches you from the characters and the plot, and also the believability of what's going on. And guess what? As a result, the audience starts to question what's going on and the realism of the story. It also starts to question every little thing that doesn't make sense or add up in the script, which unfortunately for Jurassic World Dominion, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't add up or make sense. And with the original Jurassic Park, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense, a lot of stuff that can be questioned, and a lot of continuity errors. But we believe it and buy into it because the characters are so believable. We're experiencing the story through the characters. The main story is pretty simple. Tourists get a preview of a theme park with dinosaurs, the power goes out, dinosaurs get out, and it turns into a survival film. It's pretty easy, very easy to follow. It's not overcomplicated by let's try and seem smart by adding a genetically modified scientific angle to the story, which didn't really need to be there, because we've already got enough genetically modified scientific storyline in the dinosaurs and now with the cloned girl. And there's too much going on for it to be believable. Unlike the original Jurassic Park, where you buy into it, even if the technology back in 93 couldn't bring dinosaurs back to life, they sprinkle in enough realism and enough bullshit that the audience buys it. And the audience cares about the characters. So Maisie Lockwood goes back to the lab, where we're reintroduced to Henry Wu, played by B.D. Wong, one of probably the most interesting characters in the Jurassic Park franchise. He's been in all of the Jurassic World movies and the original Jurassic Park. So Wu was back, and his arc is one of the few in the story that actually seems believable and makes genuine sense. He's behind the cloned locusts, and he's acting on the orders of the Biosyn CEO, Lewis Dodson. So the whole cloned locust plot, it does try very hard to be smart, but unfortunately it weighs the script down and detracts from, well, you guessed it, dinosaurs. It also detracts from the main point and title of the film, Dominion, because the dinosaurs are not really taking dominion over the world at this point, it's the locusts. The whole focus of the script switches to the locust plot and not the dinosaurs. There's huge chunks of this movie where dinosaurs just completely disappear altogether, and the focus is put on the older characters unraveling this corporate locust plot. I've said it a million times already, it just is completely unnecessary. So the CEO of Biosyn, Lewis, I'm guessing a lot of the inspiration for his character came from Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple. He tries his best to try and look like him with the, you know, flat white hair, the glasses, wearing pleated pants with a athletic kind of looking zip-up jacket. I thought it was a bit cliche. Lewis Dodson's character comes off as very dumb and a guy that doesn't really know what he's doing or how his company's run, which doesn't really seem realistic for a guy like that, because you'd have to be incredibly smart, if not a genius, to run a evil multi-billion dollar company and not have anyone know what they're up to. But this guy doesn't really seem to know what he's doing. So the girl is kidnapped along with Blue's baby, Beta. Let's go figure. She has a baby, and there's not a hell of a lot of explanation as to how that happened. Until Henry Wu informs us that he used a monitor lizard DNA during Blue's creation. In other words, he's making the same mistake again. The same mistake he made in Jurassic Park by using the frog DNA. It's another repetitive nod at the originals, which just dumbs down the script. Because really, you would think he would have learned the lesson the first time around, especially given the success of Jurassic World until the Indominus wreaks havoc. You think they'd have tighter breeding controls, but apparently they don't. And Blue just miraculously has a baby all on her own. The only sense that makes to put that in the script is to sell toys to kids. It doesn't really seem convincing, and it's just one of those things. It's just let's put it in the script so kids will come and see it. And this enters another pointless and confusing and nonsensical subplot. Blue and Charlotte are genetically pure copies of their original mothers, or some shit along those lines. And it doesn't come as too much of a surprise that their genes and genetic makeup can miraculously stop the locust plague. Wu doesn't want to use them for some type of twisted medical experiment. He wants to use them to save the world and himself. He wants to redeem himself for his past mistakes. But a few moments ago, he just admits to making literally the same mistake he made first time around in Jurassic Park. This whole subplot is not really well explained. He plays a video of a mother from the past, which really just drags on and doesn't serve a lot of purpose to the overall script. I mean, they were concerned about running time, so there's no time for the T-Rex opening scene, which would have been really cool, but there's time for this useless piece of information that absolutely goes nowhere and serves no real purpose to the overall story or the dinosaurs. Wu explains why Charlotte is important to his work and undoing what Bioson has done. In other words, what he has done on behalf of Bioson. And you think that Malcolm would have crossed paths with him at some point, because he couldn't just be in the lab forever. And that would have sent some alarm bells off, but you know, that's a little link that was never really explored. There is a nice mention of Site B and Charlotte Lockwood being the head of research there, but that's really about it. There's a scene where it looks like it's the control room from Jurassic Park with the weird circular windows and a whole bunch of scientists running around, but you don't get much more than that. It just really serves as another little nostalgic link to the originals that really just doesn't go anywhere and bogs the script down. So after hearing this and how her and Blue can apparently save the world, she decides to let Beta out of the cage and escape. She exits the script and isn't seen again for a while. However, there is a interesting and pretty smart kind of, it's not really a subplot, it's more of a side note that they do mention early on in the movie, which I thought was really interesting. One of Bioson's big pharmaceutical draw cards is using prehistoric DNA, aka dinosaur DNA, to cure diseases. They're using, I think, bacteria or the genetics or something of dinosaur immune systems to cure human and modern day diseases and problems, which I thought was really interesting. It's a storyline they probably should have gone down rather than the locust one. You don't have to bring a really annoying prehistoric insect back to life. It would have kept the focus on the dinosaurs, and it would have been realistic that a company like that would be investing billions of dollars in to try to rescue all the dinosaurs that have been let loose around the world. It serves two purposes. One, they get the dinosaurs, and two, they can use those dinosaurs to do experiments on their immune systems and their genetics to try and cure human diseases, and that could bring up a whole ethical debate. And that's a direction that the script probably should have gone down, in my opinion, and not the locust one. It also would have kept the focus on the Dominion part of the title, because the film starts off with dinosaurs and man coexisting, but it's lost pretty early on during the film. So by this point in the movie, there's three different plots going on with three different character groups spread out all around the globe. So you've got Owen and Claire on their way to Malta, or they're in Malta at this point. You've got Malcolm, Grant and Sattler in the Bioson Sanctuary. And you've also got Blue and Maisie in the Bioson Labs. So this brings us to the reunion between the old characters. So there's a reunion between the old characters. It's nice, it seems a little forced, but overall it's enjoyable. So one of the new characters, Ramsey, he's supposed to be Lewis Dodson's assistant, but it's very clear that he's up to something. Malcolm's intro into the film is one of the highlights. Jeff Goldblum is by far the standout, and he does make the film. The reunion is set in a lecture room where he's lecturing some of Biosyn's scientists in a very Jurassic Park-esque chaos theory-inspired speech. It was one of the highlights of the film for me. So he knows that the CEO is up to something. He knows Biosyn is not what they claim to be, and that they probably have something to do with the locusts. That's why he needs Sattler's help in uncovering the plot. So there's a lot of sneaking around labs. This sets the CEO up as being the antagonist of the film. The reunion between Sattler, Grant, and Malcolm is good. I wanted a little more emotion out of it, but you know, what can you do? Malcolm is pretty funny, and he's right as always, and provides a much-needed dose of comedic entertainment. Grant is surly as ever. As soon as we're introduced to the CEO character, you kind of know he's up to something. As soon as you intro to him, you know there's something off about him. And it really seems like they are trying to have a dig at Tim Cook and Apple. I mean, is Apple that unethical? Yeah, I know they've had a lot of problems with manufacturing in China and stuff, but they're probably not the worst company in the world. The Biosyn living facility in the main building is very corporate and very much like some of these big tech companies. It has a very cold element to it. There's guards sneaking around in the background following Malcolm everywhere. They know he's up to something. Or we know he's up to something. It seems like everybody's up to something apart from Dr. Alan Grant. So the Dino Sanctuary is in the Dolomite Mountains in Italy. It's surrounded by snow-capped mountains on each side, which you think, why the fuck would you build a dinosaur sanctuary up in the mountains? I guess it's isolated, but you know, so is a desert and so is an island, which was the original point. But I guess you can't do that again because you've already done it several times before and you've blown up the first island. The sanctuary island idea from Fallen Kingdom that doesn't really go very far would have been a hell of a lot better way to end off the series than a forested preserve in the mountains in Italy. This brings us to one of the most enjoyable action set pieces of the film, and that is Malta. There's a very cool illegal underground dinosaur market where people are buying and selling dinosaurs. They're also cooking prehistoric species. Not sure that would probably be that good for you. While the market is a bit scummy and it's full of nefarious types, it is one of the highlights. It does have a very Mos Eisley kind of feel to it. That is until the annoying woman in white turns up with a laser pointer. Kayla, the pilot, has kind of a moral dilemma. She flies the girl in to Malta to be rendezvoused with a woman in white. Malta also brings the return of Omar Sy, which is nice. He meets up with Owen and they go on their adventures, where he helps Omar Sy try to uncover the dinosaur smuggling plot for the CIA. Like most things in Jurassic Park, dinosaurs get out, they eat people, they run amok. So this brings us to the scene with the raptors and guys with guns. The woman in white unlocks the raptor boxes, they get out, and she points lasers at them, making them the target. There's enough time in the scene for the guys with the guns to have shot all the dinosaurs, but for whatever reason they don't shoot the dinosaurs or her, and they let themselves become a target. A couple are eaten, Omar Sy gets trapped on a boat, and there's a huge 20-minute action set piece here, and it's a bit over the top, but overall it's pretty enjoyable, if you turn your brain off. I did try after this point, but you know, the story is so nonsensical, it was very hard. The laser pointer, yeah, is another little connection to Fallen Kingdom, but it's really ridiculous, and in the overall scheme of Jurassic Park, it's kind of stupid. Which is fucking stupid, because if you wanted to assassinate someone, you'd have to be in the room with this giant fucking dinosaur, a gun with a laser pointer and a high-frequency box thing on it. You'd have to point the laser pointer at the target for a couple of seconds so the dinosaur, you know, has a visual of the target. Then you'd have to initiate the dinosaur to kill the target with the high-frequency noise. You could just shoot whoever you were trying to assassinate in half the time. You could have just blown the target's brains out and not wait 30 seconds to use the laser pointer and the stupid fucking noise box. But I guess the writers of that didn't really think that through. I think it's an idea that probably sounded cool and was one that was rushed into production, but is completely ridiculous and over the top. It also gives enough time for the target to get away or shoot back, and it's one of those ideas that really only works if you're in close proximity to the target, like the scene in the boatyard. So these new Ultra Raptor things are pretty scary, but the original Raptor was, you know, pretty terrifying just on its own, you know, i.e. the kitchen scene when you're a kid seeing that, raptors in a confined space, that's pretty fucking scary. And I think raptors are probably more scary in confined spaces. They are terrifying in the open, which the new ones tend to favour. All the other Jurassic Park movies, besides the first one, have favoured raptors in the open. So this is the part where Jurassic World Dominion turns into a Jason Bourne movie. Claire finds herself on a rooftop being chased by a raptor. She's a chubby redhead outrunning a raptor on a rooftop. She then runs and jumps off the roof in a very Jason Bourne-esque shot and jumps through a glass window into someone's living room, followed by the dinosaur. She gets off the roof into the back of a truck with a little help from our new pilot friend. So she manages to outrun the dinosaur on the roof on foot, but in the next scene, the two female characters are speeding away in a truck and the dinosaur is keeping pace with it. Chris Pratt finds himself on a bike and the dinosaur is keeping pace with the bike. It seems the dinosaurs can change their speed, but they can't really catch anybody. So they find themselves at the runway, they take off, Chris Pratt's following on a bike. I mean, you got to figure that he's probably going maybe 60 miles an hour, the plane's probably going 150. The dinosaur just keeps pace the whole time. He basically crash lands onto the plane, followed by a dinosaur who falls off into the water. And the second raptor on the runway completely disappears out of frame. So as an action set piece, it works. It's, you know, completely ridiculous. I mean, you've got people are being chased in trucks and motorbikes by dinosaurs. They crash into scaffolding. Dinosaurs are being clotheslined by metal pipes. It's probably some of the best action scenes in the entire film. So now all our characters are about to converge. So our heroes find themselves on the plane. They figured out that Biosyn is up to something, and that Maisie is probably being held at the Biosyn sanctuary / facility up in the Dolomite Mountains. So our trio of heroes fly to the sanctuary. They try to fly under the radar. They're picked up. They have some type of limiting device that stops the flying dinosaurs from flying too high because they've all got, you know, electronic implants in them. Go figure. That was also in Jurassic World. So they take the limiter off and the plane is torn apart by a Quetzalcoatlosaurus. Claire's in an ejector seat. She parachutes out into the sanctuary below. It's not very convincing because apparently they wanted to actually have a fallout of a real plane and decided not to. You can tell it's all green screen and her facial reactions aren't that convincing. She's scared, but she should have been terrified. It just seems like she's more acting scared than it actually was scary to experience it. So the plane crashes into the ice. Owen and Carla are uninjured, and they don't seem to get wet even after they crash into the ice. So one of the coolest dinosaurs appears, the Pyroraptor. It's a feather-covered raptor and looks probably how a real dinosaur would have looked. Makes you wonder how the raptor got there. There's a lot of security protocols at the Biosyn Sanctuary, so this random feathered dinosaur just finds its way up into the mountains and comes out of an icy canyon to attack our heroes on a frozen pool. There's not a lot of security up in those mountains. There's a little perimeter fence, but that's about it. And the dinosaur just, you know, happens to magically find them. I will say that the feathers are very realistic and the dinosaur does look really cool. However, it doesn't really fit Jurassic World and Jurassic Park's genetically modified tampered dinosaurs. It attacks Pratt. He goes into the ice. The dinosaur dives in after. Scene's kind of pointless because the raptor just swims past him and doesn't really grab or slash at him, even though it clearly has a chance. But like a lot of dinosaurs that are brought into Jurassic World Dominion, the raptor appears and disappears just as quickly. It's pretty much just for show and isn't seen again. So the pilot helps Owen out of the drink in the nick of time. They head for the conveniently placed elevator to avoid an attack and head down into the Biosyn facility. No one gets cold or freezes to death. So Claire crash lands in the dinosaur sanctuary. She's confronted by a blind, very old-looking dinosaur called a Therizinosaurus, or something like that. Probably butchered that pronunciation. It's a unique-looking creature. It looks like a giant bird or a giant prehistoric emu-looking thing. It has razor-sharp claws that are about 5 feet long, hanging off of its hands. It's pretty big. So this scene where Claire has to avoid being eaten by the Therizinosaurus, however you say it, is probably the best planned out sequence in the entire film. And it's one of the first times in the Jurassic World trilogy that one of the new characters actually faces some peril or some type of danger. It's a very cool scene. And the fact that the dinosaur is blind adds a very unique suspenseful element to the scene. Claire has to escape underwater and hide just as this thing puts its head down, and there's, you know, the vibrating ripples in the water. It's a very cool scene, and it's shot really, really well. This is another example of Colin Trevorrow showing us that he can direct a film and he can direct really suspenseful action when he wants to. Unfortunately, the rest of the movie is pretty much a mess, but this scene is definitely one of the highlights and one of the reasons that makes it worthwhile seeing. So this brings us back to the corporate bias and plot. Our likable new character of Ramsey points Sattler and Grant to the subterranean labs underneath the facility. The pair go sneaking around the labs to find the genetically engineered locusts and to prove to the world Bison is behind a corporate plot to dominate food supplies. Owen and Carla enter the park and try to find Claire with the help of a very conveniently placed GPS tracker in the ejection chair. And now we get our second but brief glimpse of my favourite character, the T-Rex. The pair are hiding. The T-Rex goes to find a freshly killed goat for a brief second before it is outside by yet another new addition to Jurassic World, the fearsome Gigantosaurus. There's a brief fight. The pair are hiding, watching this all unfold, and the T-Rex, which really you think the T-Rex would have smelled them, but you know, that's something that they do bring up in The Lost World. They also had good eyesight, which is one of the things the original Jurassic Park got wrong. But, you know, at the same time, having a predator that big, you have to give it at least one weakness to facilitate the plot a little bit, I guess. Unfortunately, Jurassic World Dominion picks and chooses which dino facts it wants to present. It picks and chooses ones that serve its plot and contradict with the original Jurassic Park. In, you know, the first one tried to be as realistic as possible, you know, minus the velociraptors. They were pretty much made up for the film. A velociraptor in reality is about the size of a turkey or a medium-sized dog, not a person. But they did make up for it in later films. The feathers and versus genetic engineering. I think they do mention that they made some dinosaurs bigger and scarier, and that's something that they do get into more in Jurassic World. So a fight breaks out between our two apex predators because the, you know, Bison CEO thought it'd be a great idea to fit two apex predators in a isolated location together, which is a fucking dumb idea. They would probably kill each other, or one would try to kill the other and take over. It also makes you wonder if they do have carnivores and herbivores mixed into a small area. Eventually, the carnivores are going to eat all the herbivores, and there's only going to be the dominant carnivores at the top of the food chain. And so there goes your dinosaur sanctuary idea. You'd need a space. You'd need a fair bit of space for all the dinosaurs to be able to comfortably live and not have to worry about being picked off by the bigger dinosaurs. But this is explained in Jurassic World Dominion. They have a population of goats they release for the carnivores to eat, which when you realistically think about it, a goat is not really going to fill up a T-Rex. He'd probably have to eat 10 or 20 of them a day. A goat to a T-Rex would be just a snack. I think Walking with Dinosaurs mentioned that. A T-Rex eats like a ton and a half, maybe 2 tons of food each day. It's like a decent portion of its own body weight to keep that huge body moving. Same goes for the herbivores. I mean, they'd probably decimate the tree population pretty quickly if they didn't have enough space to spread out and let trees and plants regenerate, which is a problem that they have with animals today. The environmental angle is one that the movie should have gone down. It kind of hints at it at the start, but then it kind of then drops it just as quickly. If you had enough if you had a limited amount of dinosaurs, it might work if you put them on an island, but if you had enough dinosaurs living side by side with humans, there wouldn't be enough resources to go around, especially when you consider all the other animal species that are being pushed to the brink of extinction by overpopulation by humans and encroachments on their environment. So a fight breaks out between the T-Rex and the Gigantosaurus. You know, guess who wins? So far, the dinosaurs have been pretty lifeless, minus the raptors, and they haven't really done a hell of a lot apart from just facilitate action scenes. That's really the sad thing with this movie, is it's supposed to be about dinosaurs, but most of the scenes that have dinosaurs in them really just facilitate action scenes and not a hell of a lot else. There's, you know, they don't have those big sweeping shots that the originals have of, you know, herds of herbivores doing their thing. Every time there's a dinosaur, especially a carnivore, it just facilitates another action set piece, like the feathered raptor that doesn't appear again in the film. It appears just because the script's getting boring and the audience needs some action. And I never thought I'd say it, but there are way too many dinosaurs in this movie. There are so many dinosaurs packed into it, it's hard to keep up with what dinosaur you've seen and what dinosaur you haven't. because you're constantly thinking, have we seen this dinosaur before? Oh no, that's a different one. That's a new dinosaur that you're probably not going to see again. It's a bit overkill, and it seems like Colin Trevorrow tried to fit every dinosaur that's ever been found into a single film. I think there's more dinosaurs in this film than the first two Jurassic Worlds combined. There's definitely more dinosaurs in this one than the entire original trilogy. Whenever the script seems to get boring, let's add a new dinosaur to give the audience some action. They only seem to facilitate the action scenes and not a lot else. The dinosaurs also don't seem like characters like they do in the first three films. I mean, Blue is really the only dinosaur character in Jurassic World. In the first Jurassic Park, the T-Rex definitely feels like a character, and so do the raptors. They feel like they have their own personality. In The Lost World, the dinosaurs definitely do feel like more like characters. The two T-Rexes and the baby are definitely some of the main characters in the film. The baby T-Rex in The Lost World appears on screen more than some of the human characters do. Dominion, the dinosaurs, like I said, facilitate action scenes. They don't really feel like characters, and the only dinosaur character we do get, Blue, is written out of the script. And most of the dinosaurs we see are only seen once or twice before exiting stage left and not appearing again. See, even some of your old favourites don't get a lot of screen time, such as the T-Rex. They're brushed aside to fit in some of the new dinosaurs. So this brings us to the Gigantosaurus. You know, it's another apex predator that's bigger and meaner than the T-Rex and the Spinosaurus. But it has very little impact on the story and kind of comes off like a corporate attack dog. It kind of fits in with Bison's motto and the corporate mentality of bigger is better. And the Gigantosaurus, as mentioned, has been the biggest carnivore and predator to ever exist. Alan mentions that during the movie, which is not true, the Spinosaurus is. But none of them can hold a candle to the T-Rex. It is, in my opinion, the best dinosaur. It might not be the biggest in terms of length, but in body weight, it pretty much matches the other two. It is by far the coolest dinosaur. It's one that I've loved since I was a kid and continue to do so. Like a lot of people around the world, the T-Rex is the coolest. So Ellie and Alan discover the locusts. They find a high-tech lab deep in the facility and for some reason doesn't have any security cameras or security systems in the sub-levels and no one knows that they're snooping around the labs. They sneak into the lab to get a sample. Like everything in these movies, all hell breaks loose, the locusts get out, cause trouble. They start attacking the characters who just escaped in the nick of time. So by this point, there are pretty large gaps in between characters and events. And this is the problem. There's too much going on in this movie, and there's too many subplots. The new characters and the old characters haven't met yet. And this is pretty late into the film, too. This is, you know, well over the hour and a half mark, if not later. And there's just these huge gaps in between characters and where they are. Beta and Maisie haven't been seen for at least 40 minutes. Malcolm hasn't been seen. Alan and Ellie have just come back into the story after being MIA for a while. And unfortunately, this is just how the movie works. Is there's just so much stuff happening. There's so many subplots and characters in it. Their stories don't really overlap. It's Ellie and Alan are doing this. Okay, we haven't seen Claire and Owen. What are they up to? Cut back to them. They have their part. Okay, let's chuck in some action because it's getting boring. Alright, cool, let's go back to Alan and Ellie. Where's Malcolm? Chuck him in for a bit. It just keeps going back and forth. It's very clumsy and it's very messy. So Claire and Owen find each other. Amazingly, Claire hasn't been eaten. By this point, you know she's not going to. And she's not wearing white high heels like she did in the first one. She's actually learnt from that mistake. Which is one of the dumbest scenes from the original Jurassic World, is when the T-Rex gets out of its enclosure and she's got the flare and she's running with high heels on with the T-Rex chasing behind her. It's dumb. She would have broken her ankle and got trampled to death. So this brings back one of my favourites and a fan favourite dinosaur, the Dilophosaurus. It's a little overdone. Claire's somehow survives in the dark until now, and she's found herself at a random observation facility in the middle of the dino sanctuary. The Dilophosauruses are surrounding her on all sides. One of them threatens her before it gets a throat grab by Owen, who picks it up and throws it. He somehow manages to sneak up on a dinosaur, which I find a little unbelievable, considering he probably would have been torn to shreds. So they reunite at the random building. Ellie and Grant get out of the lab. The alarms go off. Malcolm gets fired. And this is where he drops the big Dodson bomb. I can't remember if Lewis Dodson is introduced as Lewis or Lewis Dodson when we first meet him in the film. This is the same Dodson from the first Jurassic Park who's paying Dennis Nedry to smuggle dinosaur embryos off the island. So there's that little corporate espionage element to the first Jurassic Park, which was not really followed up in previous films. It added a cool element to Jurassic Park, but it wasn't really followed up on. And obviously the money Dodson paid Nedry was the main motivator for him to turn the power off and smuggle the embryos out of Jurassic Park, which in turn caused all the dinosaurs to break out of their enclosures and run amok. So Malcolm drops the Dodson bomb, which is a nice link to the first Jurassic Park, and is one that I think that they probably should have brought into Jurassic World, or you know, even Jurassic Park 2 or 3. The only issue, it's too little too late. Is by this point of the movie, the Dodson character is such a fucking moron and so unbelievable that you couldn't picture a guy who appears to be that stupid running a billion-dollar evil corporation. He doesn't seem to know what's going on in his own backyard. He has no idea how anything works. He relies on his assistant Ramsey to do most of the heavy lifting for him. And by this point, it's pretty obvious that Ramsey isn't who he says he is. So Dodson's meant to be the link between the trilogies. And like I said, the only issue is it's just too little too late. He really should have been brought into Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom and should have been behind the plot to take the dinosaurs off the island and then auction them off. I mean, that's something that he would do. And it seems like he should have been the main antagonist of Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom or even Jurassic World, because this is a guy that his company was trying to catch up on years of research. But in the end, he doesn't really have a hell of a lot of impact in Jurassic World Dominion. Because like I mentioned, he just comes off as too stupid to know what's really going on. But he does provide the link between the first and last film. He could have been a hell of a lot better. He could have been that shadowy figure behind everything. And it would have been cool if they had written into the script that he had something more to do with the downfall of Jurassic World. Like maybe he could have hired Vincent D'Onofrio's character to, go off of that military application thing and take over when things went south. Or, he was behind the downfall of Injun, but then I guess that kind of counters the very loose Injun story in Jurassic World. Ramsey meets Ellie and Alan at the Hyperloop. I wonder if they licensed that Hyperloop or got permission to use it from Elon Musk. The corporate plot at this point has been exposed. So Alan and Ellie enter the Hyperloop along with Maisie Lockwood. She reappears after a pretty long absence in the film and just manages to find them at the entrance to the Hyperloop. I can't remember if she has Blue with her, Blue's baby. All three of them get on the Hyperloop in an attempt to make it out of the sanctuary. Dodson, he finds the security footage, which apparently no one was paid to monitor when Ellie and Alan went into the locust lab. So Dodson sees the footage and realizes that he's been exposed. He tries to kill Ellie and Alan by conveniently stopping the Hyperloop in the old abandoned amber tunnels. A pack of Dimetrons attack, and this is just another dinosaur brought into it to facilitate another action scene. It's been pretty bland for the last 15 or 20 minutes or so, so it's well overdue for some action. So Malcolm, he gets fired. He's been escorted to the exit by Ramsey. Dodson still hasn't really caught on what's going on. There's no security accompanying Malcolm, even though in previous scenes, security is following him around wherever he goes because they know he's up to something. He takes a Jeep and drives out into the night to find the others trapped in the mine. Ramsey sees all this play out on a monitor. Alan, Ellie, and Maisie are trapped in the tunnels and about to be eaten. So he unlocks the old mine door and the group drive off into the night. Dodson uncovers what Ellie was up to and he burns the locust lab to try and cover his tracks, which sets up the climax of this overly drawn-out film in a very idiotic way. All right, I think we'll leave it there and pick that up in the next episode. We'll hopefully round out the epic review and recap of Jurassic World Dominion and Top Gun Maverick. We might even end up getting to Top Gun Maverick in the next episode. Apologies for the delay in episodes. It's been a clusterfuck of a year. I wanted to get a lot more episodes produced a lot more quickly, but things haven't turned out like that. So apologies for that, and thank you for everyone who is patient in between episodes. I've got some big ones coming up. The epic Russia versus Ukraine. Researching this show feels like it's never going to end. I'm nearly there for the first part anyway. It's a lot of history to dig through. I've nearly completed the first episode of that. I've got another part of Bioweapons, the continuation to, I think it was part 3. These episodes are coming. I am working as hard as I can to get them produced as quickly as possible. But nothing seems to want to go right this year. So definitely look out for those episodes. So I do apologise for that once again. On the next episode, we'll continue off and round out our look at Jurassic World Dominion and Top Gun Maverick. We'll pick that up in the next episode. Hopefully it won't be too long. I'll hopefully have that produced in the next couple of weeks. It's been recorded, I just have to edit it together, which is taking a long fucking time at the moment. Alright, thank you very much to everyone who listened to the end. I really appreciate it. If you'd like to support the Truth Tank, there's a few things you can do. Head on over to the Facebook page, follow and like it for all the updates on the Truth Tank. Rate and review the Truth Tank on iTunes or your preferred podcast player. Subscribe to the Truth Tank on iTunes, Google, Podbean, Stitcher, Amazon, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from. The Truth Tank is now on Instagram. I've only got about 14 followers at the moment. So I'd really appreciate it if you could spare the time and give it a like. There's not much on it at the moment, mainly just audio clips and stuff I'm still figuring out. Instagram, it's a little bit trickier than Facebook, but I will be putting out some exclusive Instagram content in the future. I should also have some Truth Tank merch out by the end of the year. I'm looking at getting some t-shirts, hats, hoodies, tank tops, stuff like that made up for the show, so stay tuned for that. Yeah, if you want to support the Truth Tank, tell people you think you might like it. Tell your friends, tell your family, people you work with. Help spread the word and get the Truth Tank out there. Big thank you to everyone who listened to the end. Next episode shouldn't be too far away. Hopefully it won't be a month this time. But until then, I'm a tank, and this is the truth. May the truth be with you. Oh,